I think what that was people coming solely for a single industry. Otherwise, San Francisco was like, where do I go because I'm so weird? Or where do I go to fit in? Or where can I find more like-minded people who are weirdos or eccentrics or, you know, a little bit off the beaten path or against the status quo?
That was photographer Chloe Sherman. I'm Jeff, and this is Storied San Francisco, a podcast all about the artists, activists, and small businesses that make this city unlike any other. This is part two of Chloe's episode with Story. If you missed part one, please go back and check that out. In this podcast, we go back in time to the 1990s. If this episode were a map, we'd zoom in, first to San Francisco, then to the Mission District, and finally to various lesbian and dyke bars, cafes, and art galleries that comprise the settings of Chloe's photography from that era. Here's the rest of my conversation with Chloe Sherman. Especially in the Mission, the dyke culture of the 90s, which is
exceptionally unique.
And that's also kind of a big part of your work, I would say now, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, so I started photographing before I went to and finally found a home in and graduated from the Art Institute, the San Francisco Art Institute. But I was taking pictures when I got here.
Okay.
And the more I was kind of excited and inspired, the more I photographed.
Right.
And just started hanging photos on the wall. You know, I started kind of doing it and editing my work and on my own, or, you know, with my, not necessarily other photographers, but with my artistic group of friends that I was meeting and befriending and becoming people that were becoming a new family.
And again, I mean, I threw out the word supportive, but I'm guessing your friends were supportive.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
As were we all, it seems.
Of each other.
Of each other.
Yep.
Of each other's like creativity and work. And so I think my first show was at the Bearded Lady Cafe where, you know, we always had revolving artworks, constant performances, whatever someone wanted to do, it was a space to do it, a teeny tiny little hole in the wall space to do it.
Yeah.
And I think, as mentioned, Kathy Opie did a foreword for my book, Renegades. It came out last summer. And I have a vivid memory of, so next to the Bearded Lady, there were different businesses. At one point, it was Kiki Gallery, owned by Rick. I don't remember his last name. I'm terrible with names, so apologies for...
It's okay.
First names might come to mind, but that's the best I can. So Rick had this fabulous little gallery, Kiki Gallery, and Kathy Opie presented, I think it was her possibly first exhibit of her dyke portraits.
Wow.
Right there. And so she was coming back and forth from LA and shooting people up here and then hung it at Kiki. And was always in the Bearded Lady, as was everybody. It was kind of a pit stop. It was everything. It
revolving
was
door kind of
a
thing.
A revolving door. It's where you found housing. It's where you met with people.
Yeah.
It's where you got breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's where you went to a show. You know, it was just a lot. Everything and anything was... It's a communal place to show up and meet people.
And this was all on 14th Street?
This is all on 14th.
Yeah. Right there. That's amazing.
And so I had a show there. Kathy came by and was like, I really like what you're doing. You have a, you know, good eye. You should consider going to art school.
Oh.
And being 21, I was like, okay, where? You know, and she had just graduated or was getting her master's or had just completed her master's, I think, actually, at the Art Institute, and was like, go to the Art Institute. So I applied and went.
Okay.
Period. That was it. Loved it. The best advice I had ever had.
Yeah.
It perfectly met me where I needed to be met at that time in my life with what my prominent interest was. And so I started at the Art Institute. So
amazing.
At that point, I began working with and editing and using this community as my ongoing project, really.
Got it. Did you have a studio or like your own dark room at home?
I had a dark room at home. A black and white dark room. Yeah. I built a dark room.
DIY.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah. Which I loved.
Did you use a zine to teach yourself how to make one?
No. I don't remember.
Oh, another how did we do that?
I wouldn't have Googled it. Yeah, right. How do we do it? I have no idea how I... You know, but I learned at school, so I just knew what I needed, and if the school was getting rid of old trays or whatever, I would get trays. And the other place I did a lot of printing was, which apparently is still there, although I don't know if it's a print darkroom, but Harvey Milk,
mm-hmm.
Harvey Milk Community Center in DuBose Park.
Mm-hmm. They call it Photo Something Center.
Harvey Milk Photography Center then. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yes.
You get the idea.
I know
exactly
what you're talking about.
It has been there a long time. And yeah, and they had a free darkroom. So,
great.
You know, you learn what you need and how to do it.
Right.
And I probably just copied what I was already doing there and was like, okay, I need chemicals. I need, and you go to a photo store.
Which we used to
and ask, what do I need? I have three trays. Which chemical, where is mm-hmm. your fixer and your developer? And can I just buy this whole big tub? Tank of it.
Yes. Know? And then
and
you
that
just
was
did
that.
It.
You just do it. Yeah.
And when
it
you say
cool.
editing, so I am naive to how analog photo work. What kind of editing do you do
so
for
editing
analog photos?
Truly just choosing images that make sense in a story. So it's one thing, and this is actually a challenge, I think, today when we have copious images to deal with on our phones, on our computers. Mm-hmm. The realization of how important it is to complete, if you're working on a project, mm-hmm. that you have to create something rather than have this photo dump, right?
Yes.
A pile of images that it's like, okay, now what? But you have to tell a story. You have to make it cohesive. You have to make it palatable to people. Make 300 into 10. And with the book, I realized some of the reaction that I've gotten from my book is it encapsulates a time, it's a little taster mm-hmm. of a time period.
Mm-hmm. A time capsule.
But it can encapsulate something that otherwise is like you have to, this decade, it's hard. We have so much. It's hard to ever picture making something small enough to digest or small enough to just kind of sum up an experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I mean by editing in, back in the day. Sure, I have thousands of negatives in my closet to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And even back then, I would have to go through and edit with each roll. I would make a contact sheet and circle and highlight.
Right.
So over time, I would decide what appeals to me and what might work together to tell a story.
There's also that thing, and, I think, now that everyone has a phone and a camera, that people who never took analog photos or film photos realize that you take it or you take a series, and then it'll be time before you actually see what that was.
Absolutely.
You can't be like, oh, that wasn't good. Let me try that again.
It's a surprise. It's like a whole...
It's a total surprise.
Other
Christmas
experience.
Morning.
Yeah. Yeah. Running, dropping off 10 rolls of film.
Yeah.
Waiting a week.
And you
going
might get nothing.
Going and picking it up. And you might get nothing.
You might get nothing, which is insane.
And and then even picking them up was a process. Like, do I have them, I have negative strips. Do I have them, put them in my glycine?
The sleeve.
Do I just have cut it myself when I have it rolled?
Right.
The cheap version is just have it rolled and you come back and I still have a few boxes of never unrolled film.
Oh, wow.
Developed or processed, but not unrolled. So they're
right.
brittle in a roll, sadly.
Right.
So I'm like, you undo it and it's like boing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's been 30 years. So it's never going to not be boingy.
Yeah.
But I mostly, because it was my work, mm-hmm. I would, have them cut, sleeved. I would get a contact sheet or make mm-hmm. my own if it was black and white. I didn't or make my own when it was color when I was at school and I could do print my own color.
Right.
And then put them in a binder, label the binder, what events or what years, usually quite vaguely. So, because I thought time would never pass.
Right.
So I was like, I would write something that to this day I'm like, oh my God, what was I talking about? It made so much sense at the time, but it does not ring true to my brain right now. Like, I just don't know what I'm referring to. Or a club, or maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'm lucky, dates. There was a period of time where I was pretty good at
identifying, but then exact dates? Or just like
usually a January
March.
Or a yeah, yeah right yeah. That's about it at best yeah but
and were so, you I'm gonna date myself
yeah
I moved here in 2000 and I
oh
yeah I was like already or whatever like you know I had a camera nothing fancy at all
yeah
but photo
digital
work.
Then
or
you had a
that
film
might
camera.
That might have been digital by then yeah. But for printing, I would go to PhotoWorks on...
Yeah. They're still there. PhotoWorks, I think.
Right.
They still exist. But
it's
yes, they were
different.
In a different location.
Yeah.
They were down across from Safeway.
Correct.
I did go to PhotoWorks for many things.
I was going
to
ask if someone, you know, at the level that you were, did
Dave
you need...
Dave still, to my knowledge, owns PhotoWorks. And opened it in probably 1991 or something.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
forever ago. I did process film at PhotoWorks, not always.
Okay.
I mean, not exclusively and not necessarily the fine art film. I would usually go to a lab of which there were dozens.
Yeah.
South of Market.
Yep.
Because every single photographer, every commercial shoot, every photo shot in the Macy's, for Macy's and
Macy's had their own. Do you know this?
They were big. They had their own
studio.
Yeah.
Yes. Someone who's been on the podcast did photography for them.
Of photographers
and, yeah.
shot for Macy's. That was like the bread and butter
Incredible.
For a lot of professional photographers here.
Incredible.
And then you bring it to like New Lab or, and they sometimes have the fastest turnaround, like a quick turn it around because the client is staying for the day. Can we get it by the end or 24 hours or something?
Mm-hmm.
But it was all, you know, and a bike messenger would bring it back and forth. Yes. So it was this whole manual, like real time, slow process that involved way more people than it does now to get a photo
totally.
To someone. It's like instant. Here, flip the camera around and show them.
One more name drop. Glasser?
Yeah.
Isn't that a photography place in South of Market?
Glasser. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There were so
That's
many.
Been
there
around
was,
for a minute.
Oh, God. There were so many. In fact, I should make a list from, I have labels on some of my contact sheets and negatives where it was from.
Okay.
Oh, God. I wish I could. Yeah. There were many. And they, in the early 2000s, began to close.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, I started saying people now are embracing film in a new, like, you know, coming full circle for many reasons, for both art and for a sentimentality, for a feeling of, like, you know, tactile, like, art form, and just for fun.
Yeah.
To do something like... Our parents did.
I was going to say, or like, to reject.
Yeah, digital.
The thing.
But at this point, I'm finally accepting digital. I'm not about to go back.
Right.
I'm finally, people ask me a lot, do you still shoot film or are you going to, you know, break, you know, early 2000s, it was difficult to find film, honestly. It wasn't just everywhere and it was, and the labs were closing. And so I struggled with digital. For a decade and then some, and finally am embracing it. So I love that people are shooting film, but I'm putting my foot down for myself.
You also, if you just picture it like your career as a pyramid, like the massive amount of base is film. It's like you've served your time.
I've served my time.
And you can always
I
go
missed
back.
It. I mourned. I've been through the whole grieving process, and now I'm coming through the other side.
The digital point.
Exactly.
Okay, well, do you want to, and you don't have to rush us through, but like, take us through the 2000s. Because I think we started briefly talking about how like things were closing.
Yeah.
People were being 2000s. Priced out.
You know what? I'm a terrible person to talk about the 2000s because my daughter was born.
Okay.
We moved out of, I mean, close, Bay Area, but out of the Mission, okay. San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Things were going to from film to digital, and I was struggling with digital. It was a very much more quiet time for me.
Okay.
You know, people, Malia, for instance, stayed.
Mm-hmm.
Never stopping.
That's Malia Spaniel for listeners.
Yeah. Yes. And so it's a great person to maybe talk about the shifts and ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Lexington, I think, closed in 2000.
In the teens, I want to say. Maybe like teens? Around 11 or 12.
Okay. So it was still, that was still going probably strong.
Yeah.
But eventually it was like, you know, we're not, probably not staying afloat.
Right.
Many people that I knew from the 90s, like I mentioned earlier, I don't want to say aged out, but shifted into a place of having families, mm-hmm. Pursuing careers in other states, New York, mm-hmm. LA, mm-hmm. or other cities, maybe chose to have families and buy a house that they couldn't afford here, wanted more space out in the East Bay or Portland or beyond Canada, you know, who knows, mm-hmm. any, like, all around. Mm-hmm. A whole slew of reasons why my immediate community began to, you know, we were in our, coming into our 30s.
Which was old at the time.
Which was old, right, so,
so old. Yeah.
And kind of like starting to do, take different direct, you know, go in different directions.
Two different things, yeah.
Sure, people stayed in the city too. there's a whole, still a handful of people I know here. But the community was, and the dot-com surge.
Yeah.
That's huge. That was huge.
Yep.
A lot of people who lived in the city were bought out or mm-hmm. priced out. Mm-hmm. So there was a time when landlords were trying to, you know, offer this huge sum of money to get the hell out of their place so they could flip it,
mm-hmm.
you know, sell it, flip it, rent, overhaul it, and, you know, remodel it and charge a lot because they could get a lot.
It's disgusting to me, but it's because they could.
They could get a lot.
It's because they could, yeah. And I also just want to, because you don't know this, maybe some of my listeners do, I moved here in 2000, uh-huh. but not for .com.
Right. Oh,
I would hope you would get that for me, but like, no.
So the face of the city, I think, began to change because
absolutely.
The people that were working, you know, the younger people that were seeking cheaper housing because they had, you know, the working people mm-hmm. whose working wage could no longer pay rent in the city as things were rising if they didn't have a rent control.
Mm-hmm.
So the city started slowly but surely being filled with .com, you know, kids or adults with really high salaries and really high and could afford really high rent. As those people came in, they're a lot less artistic.
Yeah.
They have less time. It was mostly a uniform group of same age, same color people, same gender people.
Yep.
And that really began to water down the diverse, kind of eccentric, diverse in age, in mm-hmm. class, in color too.
Yeah.
Community that San Francisco was able to house and began, culture then was changing, mm-hmm. art was changing.
Mm-hmm.
It really shifted the face of San Francisco, the kind of come one, come all San Francisco that had been in the city since the 60s, since the beginning of time.
Sometimes I'm like, I hear what you're saying, and I know you're not the first person to tell me about the 90s and the 80s, but I'm like, and to think that I actually like this place without all that stuff.
Well,
I'm like,
it didn't all disappear. You know, there's still this,
right.
Still, As we speak, my car's probably getting broken into. You gotta.
Which, yeah, God love them.
Like, there's still a gritty feel. Yeah. Like, it's just still San Francisco.
It does blow my mind that some people, you know, who've moved here maybe in the last 5 or 10 years have never been to a dyke bar, have never been to a house party.
Well, now they can. Here we are in Mother.
Now they can, yeah.
And I actually am seeing in the last few years a new surge of cool ass stuff happening.
Correct.
Baby Dykes coming to town, or like art happening, galleries. Yes. There's new art, interest in art, you know, making, buying, gallerists opening, like Schlomer House Gallery opened during COVID. Mm-hmm. A new queer run, queer, you know, kind of fronted gallery. Yep. Queer supporting artists. Mother Bar. Yes. There's a, across the street is, what's the name of the cool cafe across the street that I don't think it's queer, but
Manny's.
Oh yeah, it's queer. Is it? I don't know. It's cool. Yeah. Either way, it's a cool like community space. There's a couple of restaurants. There's a woman-owned wine store in the Castro.
It's maybe not queer, but shows at Kilowatt again.
Shows at Kilowatt. It's
I know what you're saying, and a lot of it remains to be seen. But maybe the pandemic. I always feel like, you know, could be a correction event.
Absolutely. That's a good thought. Right. A lot of people left.
I'm still banking on
that. A lot of people left.
Correct.
If you could afford to leave, maybe at that point.
People, and there's the whole thing of like, the way I frame it in my mind, because I've been here for a long time, and I came here because of what it was.
Right.
And I came here to contribute whatever my thing is. But I think there was a wave of people coming to take and coming to change the place. And I'm like,
interesting. Yes. No. I can see that. That's a good point.
It changes on its own.
Well, I think what that was people coming solely for a single industry.
Correct.
Otherwise, San Francisco was like, where do I go because I'm so weird? Or where do I go to fit in?
Yeah, 100%.
Or where can I find more like-minded people? Who are
weirdos like me.
Weirdos or eccentrics or, you know, a little bit off the beaten path or against the status quo.
Right.
And for, I think, possibly generations, that was San Francisco, along with, I don't know where
places.
Else, but...
A couple other places.
But San Francisco. Yeah. And so the 2000s, there was a huge new flood of people coming. Where can I get the highest paid job? It's Silicon Valley.
Right.
And that was new.
Mm-hmm.
That hadn't, I don't think, occurred in this city before. It just happened to be the perfect place, the perfect, you know, there was this huge .com search.
Yeah. So you left the city but stayed in the Bay Area, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So I continue to have everything in the city. You know, I work in the city. I did, all my lab stuff was still in the city. So oddly, anyway.
So I want to now fast forward to how you came into my life, which was right here.
Right here.
Well, I think Malia mentioned you. We recorded at Parkside.
Yeah.
Because they were still like barely working on this place.
Oh, right, right.
And she had mentioned you and she was like, talking about your photos of the dyke scene and of the Lex and other places back in the 90s. She's like, that's someone you should talk to. And then I finally met you at your show here. So.
Yep.
Do you want to tell the story about how that book came along?
Yeah, it's been a really wonderful convergence, kind of come full circle with, you know, connecting. I don't know if it's the kind of 20-year plus nostalgia cycle that can happen, but maybe it's the time in our lives we all are. But I'm reconnecting with friends. Or maybe it's just me that I was the one that wasn't connected, but I'm reconnected with friends from the 90s in a creative way.
It's happening to me.
Yeah.
In like 2023 was insane how many people I reconnected with from the 90s.
Interesting. Yeah. There's some kind of
something's
like,
happening.
Yeah, something's happening.
Planets or whatever you want to believe. Yeah.
So during COVID, our daughter was home, her friends were home. Everyone went off to college and then we're like, oh, hi, I'm back. You know,
kidding.
Whoops.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just kidding. I guess we're all moving right back into our childhood rooms for a while. And so they would socialize out back. And I think at one point my daughter saw a couple of images of mine floating around Instagram. So okay. I've had images printed in books, you know, people, mainly it would have been from that actually. And she was like, you know, you should really, you know, start, you know, open your, an Instagram account, like a, not just a mom and cat and kid Instagram,
right.
but like start a business account and, tag yourself. Like, why are you, nobody knows who to even say this. They mention your name, but there's no one to tag. So she did it, her and a friend, and my niece, we were all kind of like, following, like, oh, I have 5 followers. That's so exciting.
Right.
After tagging a couple photos. Mm-hmm. And then it inspired me. She's like, get more out there. Start, where are they all?
I love it. It was like, your daughter.
It was. And so amazing. I started, I got a scanner. I started long hours at home, sifting through photos, scanning, and posting. And the reaction was so both endearing and intense and overwhelming and amazing. And people, all of us, were like, high school reunion. Like, look at these. We've not seen so many of these photos. I hadn't even seen many of the photos. As I'm looking through negatives, I'm like, I've never done anything with this. I've never, many I had printed, but none that, you know, nothing.
You hadn't about shown, 50% shown them
of the book was never.
Never seen.
Printed or chosen by me to use for anything.
Yeah.
So I was rolling them out and people were kind of going crazy and excited for ourselves and for each other. And then the interest grew a little beyond that. Schlomer House Gallery, Stefan and Brandon reached out to me and were like, we're looking for artists, queer artists. And we found your Instagram. You know, it just became a domino effect. Do you want to have a solo show?
Oh.
And that was 20, whenever. It was the first opening, that first summer restrictions really dropped.
That were, first summer, 2020.
That first summer, 2020? Yes. What are we, 2020?
There was like a brief.
It was 2 years ago. There, so it was like maybe that kind of second summer. Like
post-Omicron.
We were vaccinated. Yeah, post-Omicron.
Yes.
So I, at that point, was very new, like raw getting back into this. Like, oh my God, okay. I have to have these professionally scanned now. This, my little home scanner is not cutting it. I have to, you know, I want to print these. And I said yes to this show, which really kicked off this explosion of both us all reconnecting and then the work itself taking on a life of its own. So the show that happened, there were probably 300 people that showed up.
Oh,
people were
wow.
in tears.
Yeah.
People were taking photos of themselves in front of their
photo. Oh wow.
It was all night long. And then we went off to, you know, this El Rio what's it called? Virgil's.
It was Virgil's.
Room.
Yeah.
Oh, now it's already.
It's I think it's called Mothership.
Oh,
which is
okay.
interesting. And I don't
know. So it was
Layla
that it's queer now. And their partner. This was 2 years ago. We're running it. And so I, you know, they were like, okay, Lexington's closed. We can't have a party there.
Right.
So how about here? And it was enormous. It was so, like, such a touching.
I was going to say powerful night, right?
It was a powerful night. Like, I mean,
on so many levels.
Many of us hadn't seen each other in 25 years.
Yeah.
And so we all just showed up like nothing ever happened.
Right. Right.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
And memorable. And strangers were there. Mm. Like, this is the most, you know, so I had a younger people who showed up were also just like, this is so moving. This is why I moved to San Francisco, but I miss the 90s. But this is so, you know, exciting to be part of both photographically get to see, you know, walk through this time. And this was only like 35 photos at the time. Get to walk through the experience and then be immersed in this crowd.
In the crowd of people who were in the photos. I'm
just
guessing
kind of
these are people
close
like.
Close people.
Born after the photos were taken.
Yeah.
Some.
Yeah, or moved to San Francisco after.
Right.
Moved to San Francisco after. So,
right.
Just even the gallerists who were there, I think they were here in the 90s, but they were just like, oh my God, this is such a flood of emotions and memories and, you know, people showing up.
Yeah.
In mass. And that itself was unique, to have everybody show up and be in one place together and just...
That is so
like,
cool.
It had been a long time since something like that happened in that, to that degree. Like, well, it was just huge.
What I mentioned earlier, I was like, people who haven't been to dyke bars or houses, but also art openings.
Right.
Art openings were huge.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
That's true.
Do you know in that show, or maybe in the book, at least year-wise, what is the oldest photo? It'd probably be when you moved here, right?
It was when I moved. You know, I have some from then that did not make it to the...
Right.
The book was a very tight edit.
Right.
For a number of reasons. I wanted it palatable in one sitting. Mm-hmm. And it was... And not like you need a break halfway through, mm-hmm. like some big coffee table books. Mm-hmm. I love coffee table books, but also it's like a few sittings. You start flipping. Like,
because it's always there.
It's always there, and you're kind of like, you reach a absorption limit.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Where you're just like, I can't right now. I got to stop. Mm-hmm. So I wanted the book to feel like you could start from front cover to back cover, put it down, and just feel like you went on this, you were lost for a moment.
Right.
And satiated, and also you completed the book, and you kind of had this incredible little glimpse of a time and place.
A journey. Went back. And,
And so editing, I mean, already I'm like, there's about four photos that I wish I had made, wish I had chosen to put in and not pulled.
Mm.
But it happens. So the oldest photo, it's certainly in the book, is probably the one on the way to Folsom Street Fair, which I think is 1994.
94.
I think. I'm really bad with
that. That would be 30 years ago.
Yeah.
This year.
And there are about six people turning around at the Bearded Lady. It's a black and white. And those early ones were black and white.
Yes.
Before I delved into color and never left.
Is there any... I want you to tell people how they can find the book.
So the book is available. The book is called Renegades, San Francisco, the 1990s. It's available at many local bookstores. If you're in San Francisco, it's at City Lights. Okay. It's at Fabulosa in the Castro. It's at San Francisco MoMA. It's at... If a bookstore that's easy to get to you, if those aren't... Green Apple Books, even, out there. Okay. Anybody can order it.
Okay.
Also, it's online.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's on Amazon. They intermittently do these weird sales that I'm not going to promote that because it wildly frustrates bookstores. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they do it. You know, but they're selling the book, and if that's the only way you can get it, then that's also valid.
Is it at Powell's?
I'm sure it's at Powell's.
Yes!
Come full circle
full
to Powell's.
Circle.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Also love that place.
And it's all through in Manhattan. People walk by, friends have walked by and showed. It's in a few, you know, storefront windows in Manhattan and Brooklyn. And a few shows coming up. I actually may have something coming up at SF MoMA in the fall.
Okay, great.
And a show in Switzerland, which is probably not that very accessible to most listeners.
That's okay. I know something on February.
But my website and Instagram is where to check for upcoming both events and book access.
Do you want to tell people the URL? Yeah.
Oh, Chloe Sherman Photography. And Instagram is Chloe D. Sherman.
Okay. Can we end with every season, I should say, on this podcast, mm-hmm. we have a theme. And this season, the theme is We're All In It. What
We're
does that mean
it.
To you?
We're all in it.
I think your photos tell that story, but what does it mean to you in words?
That's your seasonal theme. We're all in it. So, I mean, I think if it relates to community, I think my photos and what we've been talking about, what I've been hearing Malia talk about with reasons for opening mother and seeking space and community, we're all in it kind of esoterically as all for one for all, as queers supporting each other, and even physically, like in finding spaces and supporting and participating and attending spaces where we can face-to-face meet each other, you know, have a dialogue, communicate, see each other's work. Here at Mother, they have a revolving art show as a slideshow. I mean, even seeing, there's the photo booth. Like, for me, I relate to tangible. I am moved and inspired in a place. When I'm home, it's easy for me to, I kind of lose momentum, lose track, lose motivation, lose inspiration. It's hard to figure out, it's hard to make art. I mean, there's moments, but I'm most engaged and inspired, you know, hopping into a actual photo booth.
Is
the funnest time I've had in a while was meeting an old friend. We were doubled over tears of laughter in the photo booth, missing the timing of the shoot. So like on my desk right now is the photo of us in every form of mid-face move we could for like three different strips. So things like that, all, you know, it's coming together. It's emotionally, physically, even, you know, esoterically, politically. It's important as humans to be all in it together. If you find like-minded people or something, you want to be all in.
That was Chloe Sherman. On the next episode of Storied San Francisco, meet Linda, Brian, and Marlon, some of the amazing humans who own and operate Mitchell's Ice Cream. Episode 13 drops next Tuesday, wherever you get podcasts. Music for Storied San Francisco was produced, performed, and curated by Otis McDonald. Aaron Lim of Bitch Talk Podcast is our contributing producer. And the show is produced and hosted by me, Jeff Hunt. Now in our sixth season, we have more than 200 episodes available on our website, storiedsf.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're able to, please rate and review the show. And drop us a line at storiedsf@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Keep rejecting those silly doom loop narratives about our city. Stay wacky, weird, healthy, and creative. And we'll see you next time on Storied San Francisco. We acknowledge and respect the first humans of the unceded land we call San Francisco, the Ramaytush Ohlone. We condemn the genocide of these and other tribes across the Western Hemisphere. We honor their legacy and history, and we support rematriation and sovereignty efforts.
This podcast is a proud member of the BFF.fm podcast network. Learn more at podcasts.bff.fm.
BFF.fm, best frequencies forever.